What does motion sound like? With Kizik Hands Free Shoes, it sounds a little something like this. Experience the magic of motion. Get a free pair of socks with your first order at kizik.com/socks.
Hey, it's Ron. I'm really excited for you to hear today's episode. We'll dive into how the reapportionment process could impact the balance of power in the U.S. House of Representatives. But before we get started, I wanted to let you know that the Census Bureau actually released their reapportionment numbers after we recorded this episode. So throughout it, we talk about potential and hypothetical changes, but the final numbers are now available. Just so you have a frame of reference, Texas picked up 2 seats in the House and 2 electoral votes. Florida, Colorado, Montana, North Carolina, and Oregon all picked up a seat and 1 electoral vote. In California, Illinois, Michigan, New York, Ohio, Pennsylvania, and West Virginia all lost a seat and 1 electoral vote. Enjoy the episode.
Hi, I'm Daniel, founder of Pretty Litter. Did you know cats tend to hide symptoms of sickness and pain? I learned this the hard way after losing my cat, Gingy. So I created Pretty Litter, a health monitoring litter that helps detect early signs of illness by changing colors, saving you money and potentially your cat's life. Pretty Litter is veterinarian developed, and it's the easiest way to keep tabs on your fur baby's health right at home.
Go to prettylitter.com and use code SPOTIFY for 20% off your first order and a free cat toy. Terms and conditions apply. See site for details.
Welcome to Politicology. I'm Ron Steslow. In our first Drawing Democracy episode, we talked briefly about the way the 435 seats in the U.S. House of Representatives are divided or apportioned between the 50 states. Now that we're right around the corner from the U.S. Census releasing their official population data, which will dictate the next reapportionment and redistricting process this year, I want to look at what that's going to mean for the balance of power in D.C. My guest today is probably the best person to break this down for us, Dave Wasserman. Dave is the House editor for the Cook Political Report and an NBC News contributor. He's one of the nation's top election forecasters. His election commentary has been cited in Politico, The New York Times, The Washington Post, The Wall Street Journal, The Economist, and Real Clear Politics, just to name a few. In 2019, Dave was named a Pritzker Fellow at the University of Chicago's Institute of Politics, where he led a seminar entitled Mapping Our Future, Forecasting Elections and Redistricting in 2021. Dave, it's a great pleasure to have you here.
Thanks for having me. I'm looking forward to nerding out.
This is our nerd series. So we did an overview already in this series of how the apportionment process works with our listeners. That was back on February 25th. So I think it's okay to just dive right in to which states we expect to gain and lose seats based on the preliminary estimate data we're seeing now.
Yeah, so Texas and Florida are usually the big winners, and that's going to be true this time around again. We're looking at potentially Texas gaining 3 seats, going up from 36 to 39, Florida gaining 2 seats, going up from 27 to 29. We're looking at 5 other states that could pick up a seat each: Arizona, Colorado, Montana, North Carolina, and Oregon. And then on the negative side of the ledger, there's this familiar frost belt decline. We're looking at Illinois, Michigan, Minnesota, New York, Ohio, Pennsylvania, Rhode Island, and West Virginia losing a seat each. But Alabama and California are also on the cusp of losing a seat. This is really where we're in suspense heading into the reapportionment release. Whether Alabama or California will lose a seat, whether New York will lose a second seat, the margins here could be quite close. And every time some state ends up on the short end of the stick, they typically sue over the census's approach. And this time around, it could be more controversial than normal because the census has employed new tabulation methods, including differential privacy, to try and address some of the unique challenges with conducting a census this go-round. So we'll see whether those lawsuits get anywhere, but that's basically the shift that we're expecting. And if you were to allocate those 10 seats, shift those 10 seats from the losers to the winners, Joe Biden would have won the Electoral College with four fewer votes than he did if he were to rehold the 2020 election under the new apportionment count. So it gives you just an idea of the small boost that reapportionment alone offers to Republicans.
So we've talked about already how all of the district boundaries ultimately end up in litigation. Most of them end up in litigation after the fact. But we haven't talked at all about litigation over the methodology that the census uses to count. And that's something I'm not familiar with. Can you expand a little bit on that?
In 2000, Utah narrowly missed out on gaining a fourth district. And they sued on the grounds that the census didn't properly account for Mormon missionaries who were abroad. They lost that suit, and subsequently, Utah picked up a fourth district because of its high growth in 2010. This time around, the census is not only having to resort to more estimation methods than normal because of the lower response rate due to the pandemic. It's kind of had to make some guesses of how many people are living in households that didn't respond. But it's also employing a controversial new data privacy approach called differential privacy, which essentially means that in order to safeguard the census data from being mined for personal information, it's swapping some of the demographic characteristics of people living in one census block with people living in census blocks nearby. Republicans are up in arms. I'm talking to a number of Republican strategists who believe that this means that we won't have an accurate or exact count. The truth is that we never have had an exact count of how many people were living in certain blocks on the census date. But there are going to be more questions about this than normal.
That sounds like it could have a big impact on the majority-minority districts and how those get drawn. Do you think so?
Well, Democrats have long alleged an undercount of minority communities in the census. And it's possible that now that the Biden administration has taken over, that there will be less of an undercount than there would have been if the Trump administration were still in charge. But it's really hard to say because we'll never know.
So obviously, even after the seats are reapportioned, states are going to need to go through their redistricting processes. But Democrats currently control the House with such a narrow 6-vote majority. You mentioned the electoral math at the presidential level. How do you think reapportionment might impact the balance of power in the House? And I know all this depends on how the district boundaries shake out, but is it possible even to estimate that right now?
Well, Republicans need to pick up only 5 seats to regain the House majority, and Texas and Florida are likely to gain a total of 5 seats. Those are both states that Republicans control. Now, you can look at some of the other states as well, and Rhode Island and West Virginia probably cancel each other out. If Rhode Island does lose a second district, it's guaranteed to be a Democrat. If West Virginia loses a third district, then that's guaranteed to be a Republican because those delegations are all blue and red, respectively. But it's a closer call as to how redistricting shakes out in some of the other states that would gain or lose. And keep in mind that even in states that don't gain or lose, there are going to be fraught redistricting battles.
So this is what I want to dig into. As we start to think about the redistricting process, the number of seats held by members of each party in each state doesn't really align with the actual voters or their partisan preferences. So for example, Arizona is really pretty proportional if you think about it in terms of proportionality. So in 2018, Gallup had 41% Democrats or lean Democrats, 41% lean Republican, or Republican, and they've got 9 seats, 5 are Democrats, 4 Republicans. But you go to Kentucky, and the same year, Gallup has 42% Dem, 45% Republican. Kentucky has 6 seats, only 1 is a Democrat, and 5 are Republicans. So when we think about how this go-round is going to shake out and the proportionality differences in each state, what would we expect? I know this is purely hypothetical and it's a fantasy because it's never going to shake out this way, but just so that our listeners sort of have a benchmark for if proportionality were to be, say, inserted into the hierarchy of statutes that the map drawers have to follow in some way, what would the House look like? What would the composition look like?
Well, theoretically, it would look pretty close to the country's breakdown as a whole. But what I always say to people is, if you want proportionality, don't expect it through districting. Look, if you were to take the state of Massachusetts and say, well, you know, let's have proportional partisan representation in Massachusetts, you'd say, well, Democrats should get 6 seats and Republicans should get 3 seats. Well, guess what? It's pretty much impossible to draw even one Republican seat in Massachusetts because Democrats dominate most regions of the state. You know, you might be able to draw one that very narrowly, you know, would elect a Republican in a good year. But, you know, and you can take Republican states where the opposite is true. And so the question of what's fair, people of different persuasions come up with a lot of different answers to that question, which is a big obstacle to reform and getting anything done. You know, my take, having watched this for a couple decades, is that the most successful reforms have been ones that forbid taking partisanship into account at all. They've typically led to the most competition. They've led to the most potential for turnover. And, you know, what California did in 2010 took a lot of heat. It took a lot of effort. But in the end, I do think it led to robust competition, or much more robust competition than it otherwise would have seen.
Do you think that a competitiveness standard would also help with competition, or do you think that would also get in the way?
It could, but keep in mind that competitiveness can be a moving target. And right. You know, this is where I think things start going down rabbit holes that are unhelpful to the overall cause of reforming gerrymandering, is everyone's coming up with their favored standard. For a while, the efficiency gap was in fashion, but it was not embraced by the Supreme Court, which ruled that you can't bring partisan gerrymandering claims in federal court. And there are flaws with each metric that's used to evaluate how gerrymandered a map is. And let's say that you've got a competitiveness standard that's based on presidential election results. Well, that can differ a lot from party registration, which is often a lagging indicator. Do you use the congressional results from past years? Well, in some cases, you know, there were uncontested races in districts or extremely weak candidates that lead to, you know, kind of a misestimation of a district's competitiveness. Or you can use how many Democratic and Republican votes there are, but that kind of assumes that there aren't independents who are evaluating candidates based on their individual right. strengths and weaknesses. So in Arizona, back in 2010, the commission's chair, Colleen Coyle Mathis, was impeached for passing a map that effectively maximized the number of competitive districts in the state and gave Democrats a chance to win 5 of the state's 9 seats. Well, you know, one of those seats that was supposedly competitive at the outset of that decade is now a solidly Democratic seat just because the suburbs of Phoenix have become a lot bluer. So the intentions of mapmakers in the immediate aftermath of the census can be overtaken by trends in the course of the decade to follow.
So to sum up, is there a particular reform or technique that you think could ultimately lead to more competitive districts, less partisan gerrymandering, or less, you know, less gerrymandering in general? What would you put at the top of that stack of things that would have a high impact on competitive districts?
Well, I think in practice, the California style reform holds the most promise as a blueprint for other states. And in fact, I think you've seen Colorado and Michigan head in that citizen-led commission path.
Yeah.
Now, there are other commissions out there that have much different approaches, and not all commissions are designed alike. You know, New Jersey's commission and Virginia's commission are appointed by state legislative leaders. Oftentimes, they have marching orders to protect certain incumbents, and yeah. there's a lot of wheeling and dealing that goes on. It's not exactly removed from politics. And New Jersey, in fact, has produced a number of very gerrymandered maps using a commission. So we have to be careful about the criteria and the source of power for these commissions. I'm actually a fan of algorithmic approaches to districting. And although a lot of the algorithms that various computer scientists have come up with would make it difficult for election administrators because they, you know, draw lines that cross a lot of county and municipal boundaries and so forth. I think there is a way to optimize it in a way that this could be a simple algorithmic,
an AI-driven
function
solution
that maybe takes into account some pre-existing county or municipal boundaries, and where this process could simply be luck of the draw. I know that there's a response from a number of people who say, well, how can that possibly be compatible with the Voting Rights Act? I think we tend to underestimate the number of states where the Voting Rights Act has created overly packed minority districts that have inhibited minority candidates' chances of winning in multiple seats. The effect of, you know, the current regime of majority minority seats, I think, has been to confine minority candidates into certain districts and make surrounding seats, essentially unwinnable.
I think that's right. You know, it certainly would do away with the problem of, you know, every single legislator lobbying the map drawers to make sure that their home is in the new district where they're, you know, where they're going to live. And we just had David Becker on to explain all of the nuances of the Voting Rights Act. And if they could get around that, I mean, if you could come up with a way to, maybe a solution would be you use an algorithm for the first pass and then go in and adjust where you need to for communities of interest to comply with the Voting Rights Act. Seems like it would be a much better start, but only allow deviants from the AI-driven map for that purpose.
Yeah, I mean, I think that's a reasonable start. I mean, I just think of how much money and stress we could save the country from going to, you know, from what we currently have to something that is more luck of the draw.
Okay, so let's talk about the overall representation now, out of the weeds and into the sky, I guess. So all this math gets done, all of the dividing gets done with a finite number of seats, 435 for the House. So that's been the case for about a century, but the population has grown around 170% since that 435 seat cap was put in place, according to the American Academy of Arts and Sciences. In 1911, when that 435 number was first set, each member of Congress represented about 200,000 people. And in 2018, the average population of a district was 750,000. James Madison, as we know, actually proposed a formula tying the size of the House to the total population of the United States as the First Amendment to the Constitution. So we're now poised to see a massive swing in the number of constituents per representative this year in states like Rhode Island, like you mentioned, and Montana. Do you think it's time to expand the size of the House, and what impact could that have on the balance of power?
Yeah, I think it's reasonable to consider expanding the House, but it's also a Band-Aid, because let's say we went from 435 to 635. Well, in 20 years, we'd kind of be back in the same place. Yeah. You know, we passed the threshold beyond which it doesn't make sense for members to knock on doors a long time ago. You've got to raise millions to run TV ads to win congressional districts these days. And, you know, I don't think even doubling the size of the House would really change that all that much. What it could do is create some opportunities for, you know, more Republicans to get elected in blue states and more Democrats to get elected in red states. You know, I worry that the overall impact, small d democratically, from this round of redistricting will be to make blue states even more lopsided in that direction and red states even more lopsided in the other direction. And that, of course, continues this trend of Americans who are just not exposed to other points of view or don't have to respond to the other side.
Just for context, I just want to offer these numbers. Rhode Island's going to go from 526,000 constituents per seat to 1.1 million constituents per seat. Montana is going to go from 989,000 to 540,000 constituents per seat. All right. So, Dave, what are the top things that voters should be paying attention to throughout this process? We've talked a bit about, redistricting. Our listeners especially like to get involved at the local level, and they want to do as much as they possibly can to influence outcomes. Where's the highest value, piece of activism that they can get involved in, given that redistricting is one of those things that tends to happen behind closed doors, whether it's in a commission's closed doors or the legislature's closed doors, and individuals don't necessarily have access to that process. However, in the litigation, usually every single person who's in a district has standing to sue or can join a lawsuit after the fact. So when people say, I want to get involved, I want to make sure that districts are drawn fairly, what recommendations would you give to them?
Well, in most states, there are public hearings regarding districts. I know that because there's a shorter window to get this done, given the pandemic, that there may be fewer opportunities than there were 10 years ago. But if you want, as a citizen, for a certain community to be kept together or certain communities to be in the same district, come armed with maps. And it's easier than ever to draw maps yourself. One of the new features of this year that makes it different from past cycles is that there's been a real democratization of mapping technology. It used to be that to draw a legal official map, you needed to buy expensive software that ran into the five digits. And it was really only the domain of...
And hardware that could run it.
Right. Political professionals. And this time around, there are multiple applications that are browser-based that can allow citizens to essentially do the same thing with, a short tutorial. So take advantage of that.
Yeah, there was one that you mentioned on Twitter a while back called Dave's Redistricting App, I think. I haven't checked that out, but maybe that's a good place for people to start.
It is, and I find it very user-friendly. It's also very feature-rich, with 2019 census estimates, including estimates for citizen voting age population, which is really essential for drawing districts that are compliant with precedent under the Voting Rights Act. It's got election results for a lot of different races, most cases the 2016 presidential election. In some cases, they're adding data for 2020. So it gives you a good partisan baseline of what you're drawing. And you can also, share your maps on a variety of social media. So check it out. What I'm doing actually is for cookpolitical.com, I'm drawing a forecast map, in some cases, multiple maps for each state to go along with my state-by-state analysis of what's happening. And so subscribers have access to those at cookpolitical.com.
Oh, that's terrific. Okay. And we should also note Dave's redistricting app is not you, Dave. It's a different Dave.
Yeah. Right? It's a retired Microsoft engineer in Seattle named Dave Bradley. And I've met him a few times. Great guy.
That's super cool. Dave Wasserman, thank you for being here. Before I let you go, where can everybody find you on the internet?
Well, I'm at Redistrict on Twitter, and I write for the Cook Political Report. So we've got analysis of every state there. And, just perhaps a final word. I think we're going to be awash in partisan disinformation about redistricting in the year or two to come. Although it's not top of mind right now, I think it's going to explode in public consciousness once legislatures start drawing maps this fall. And if you're not a fan of whataboutism, then you probably shouldn't be paying attention to the conversation on Twitter or anywhere else about gerrymandering, because this truly is a topic on which neither side has a moral high ground. We're going to see very creative maps proposed in a lot of Republican states, whether it's Florida or North Carolina or Georgia, Texas. We're going to see some creative Democratic maps in places like Illinois and Maryland. The bottom line is both parties are going to gerrymander because they can. And Congress has failed thus far to step in. The Supreme Court failed to step in. It's up to citizens, and it has been citizens, to pass reform initiatives on a state-by-state basis. And if you don't like what's happening, push harder for change for the next time.
Good point and well said. Thanks for being here, Dave.
Thanks a lot.
Thank you to everyone at home or on the go for listening. If you have questions or advice for us, you can reach us, as always, at podcast@politicology.com. If you enjoy the show and you find this work meaningful, you can also help us by rating and reviewing the show wherever you get your podcasts and by sharing this episode. And make sure you're following us on Twitter and Instagram @politicologypod. I'm Ron Steslow. I'll see you in the next episode.